The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition. We're in the midst of a multi-episode series on the minimum dignity floor concept, which is part of our philosophical approach to retirement planning. Those who've been listening, I've lost count now. This is either show three or I don't think we've hit four yet, but maybe we are on four.
I think this is four, isn't it?
I think it might be. So we're essentially answering questions at this point that were raised from our initial couple of shows where we described the minimum dignity floor, the nuances to that. If you're tuning in to this show as your first show, you probably want to go back a couple and hear us describe what we're talking about. Quick recap, I promise it'll be quick. Minimum dignity floor represents those expenses that we want you to cover no matter what. They're very important. Food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. And we target those because we believe you need to cover those expenses to maintain your basic standard of living. And we propose that you cover those expenses with a resource that can't run out. In our idea of that is to use secure income to cover those expenses. That's the short version. Long version takes several shows. So you can tune in if you're interested. So today we've got a slew of questions we're trying to get through, and a lot of the same type of question. Jim warned me that we're going to dive first into some questions about income taxes as they relate to the minimum dignity floor, and then we've got a bunch of other random ones as well. So we'll try to get through as many as we can today. And this may or may not be the last show on this topic. We'll just have to see how we do. So
I thought we were going to try to beat the record and do five shows.
That's not really
six shows.
A goal I want to have. I think if we are forced to do it and it ends up that way, I guess I'll give in. But
well, if you literally want me to answer all or most of the questions that have come in on minimum dignity floor, it's going to take another show or two after today. Even I'm just saying,
even with some consolidation, I know. Let's.
Well, we're going to consolidate. I have five questions that all have to do with taxes.
Okay.
So you're going to do one answer for five questions. I'll read the questions. Some are a little bit verbose. They must have came from a relative of yours. And there's some that are just like a sentence barely, which clearly came from my relatives. So I figure we can wipe out these five questions on not necessarily income taxes, taxes in general, because as you'll most likely explain in your answer, I'm assuming, there's different types of taxes, and we adjust for them differently in the minimum dignity floor. But yeah, it's going to take a couple more shows. And remember, we asked our listeners to write if they've had enough of this and they'd like us to move on. A luxury we didn't give them when you did that five-part series on QLEX a few years ago.
And have you gotten anyone asking to put an end to this minimum dignity floor madness?
None. That's my point. None. Okay. Instead, we get minimum dignity floor questions. We don't get, hey, there's enough. Move on.
Okay.
So anyways, if someone is fed up with it, you can simply write and let us know. But I have not received enough. Instead, I've got more questions. And to me, I mean, all jokes aside, folks, I think the minimum dignity floor is not only the foundation of our approach to retirement planning, in the sense we believe in protecting it and covering it with lifetime guaranteed income, Social Security, pension, income annuity. You all know that spiel, if you will. But the minimum, and I like to call it minimum lifestyle floor. I wish I called it that instead of the minimum.
Too late to change it now.
I know. But keep that in mind, because people fixate on the word dignity, and it sounds like they're just about keeping their head out of poverty. Again, that was in honor of the elderly woman I bought strawberries for. But it's really the minimum lifestyle floor. It essentially is going to be 60%, probably maybe 50 on the low end, 70 on the high end, 60 on the most typical end, percent of your expenses you will incur during retirement. Mm-hmm. It is something to take seriously. If you don't like our approach, but you still like some of the advice we give and questions we answer, that's great. Keep listening to the podcast. Keep learning. But you will have to satisfy those expenses, like it or not. And that's the key. We isolate them. A lot of advisory practices don't. Not all. Many do. We're not unique. Some don't. They just put your expenses in one big lump sum, or they just limit your spending every year and tell you, you make the expenses fit. Here's how much you can spend every year. You make it work. Again, these are approaches that we don't do. But if you don't satisfy the minimum dignity floor expenses with lifetime guaranteed income, our preferred way of doing it, they still have to cover them, Chris. Mm-hmm. They still have to cover them. Okay, so enough of that. We once got an email. We're not going to read that email today. But do you remember someone proposed to us? Gosh, I would have to say this is about 2 years ago now, maybe three. That we, instead of having five categories of expenses, add a sixth. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was a man, but I could be wrong. His recommendation was to add what, Chris? I'm hitting you out of the blue with this, but you should be able to guess. What did he want us to add to food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care?
Well, ice cream, was it?
Well, yeah, well, ice cream is guaranteed, especially if you're dating Rachel like I am. The woman like mainlines.
See, I need a little ice cream with my strawberries. So, no, I'm sure he was talking about taxes, because that comes up all the time. And I'm not shocked at all that we have, you said five in your hands. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised it's that low, the number of questions about.
I thought we would have more.
Minimum dignity floor as it relates to income taxes, because we don't list it as a category. Food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, no mention of taxes in that. So what the heck is going on, people
exactly.
are saying. Yeah.
So I'm going to read the questions, and Chris is going to do most of the talking here. Number one, because you know, folks, that he always does. He hogs the show, takes over, doesn't shut up, and goes on forever. So we're just going to have to relent ourselves to that. But also, he does the planning now at the firm. My position, as most people know, has evolved, especially since my stroke almost 2 years ago. But he is knee deep in this, like I was about 5 years ago, knee deep in this. So it only makes sense for him to be answering this question. Before I read the questions, though, and release it to him, I want to get a few points in, because I'm the one who came up with this idea, and I'm certainly not robbing you, Chris, and everything you have done over the past 12 years. He has fully helped and believed in it. But as I was developing this concept of the minimum dignity floor, and I kept thinking to myself, these are expenses that will continue forever, whether you have money or not. I was continuing to look at it through the lens of a safe withdrawal rate, almost, if you will, folks, that people were going to have an IRA or a brokerage account or some type of money that they were going to spend on covering these minimum dignity floor expenses. Now, granted, we would always, or in my initial concept of what has become, we call it the secure retirement income process. At the beginning of that, I knew, Chris, there would always be some type of secure incomes, whether it be Social Security and pension, or Social Security, pension, and income annuity, or any structure of those three. But other dollars that were going to be used to cover these expenses, especially if they came from a retirement account, here's the bind I was running into. To me, if you have the money to cover the expense, you would have the money to cover the tax. It's kind of an after-tax view, which we don't concentrate on enough. But I also knew if your money ran out, even though food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses do not stop, if your money ran out, the income taxes owed on that shortage, if you will, between your minimum dignity floor and your secure income, there is a shortage. You need more income to cover that. You're not going to get a bill for the government for income taxes you would have owed if you had the money to cover those expenses. They're not going to send you a bill. But your food continues. You run out of money, you still have to pay for food and utilities and transportation, housing and health care. So I always kind of took that into account, or at least acknowledged it, but we probably didn't explain it enough and take into account enough how we look at taxes. And taxes is a generic term, and it can cover income taxes, which is what most people think of. But there's also use taxes, there's sales taxes, there's taxes tied to property, there's consumption taxes, there's sin taxes if you smoke or drink or do other things that the government has deemed to be wrong. So there's all these other taxes. Chris will explain to you how all of these taxes, not just income taxes, are accounted for. Okay. So let's just get to the questions. I'll kind of read through them. Pause me if you want to add any clarity or answer something right away. But I'm just going to try to read these five questions, and then you can go from there.
Okay.
Okay. First one, which is very short, clearly came from my side of the family. It says, do you include taxes in the minimum dignity floor, especially those driven by required minimum distributions in excess of the floor? I think I kind of hinted to that answer. If not, how do you consider projected taxes in estimating your fund number? Now, let me pause there. Do you want me to read all five, mm-hmm. or do you want to do one at a time?
No, because then I think when you read them afterwards, we'll be saying, well, we already answered that. So why don't you...
Do you need me to run these literally after I read them across the hall so you have in front of you?
No, I'm taking notes as you go. That one was pretty easy because it's short. If it's,
got an overwhelming
amount of information, maybe I'll ask you for some clarification. But so far, I've got this one handled.
Okay, perfect. Okay, next one came from Washington. State, not Washington, D.C. Says, Jim and Chris, is there a level of liquid assets that you feel is adequate such that a couple would not need to consider an income annuity to make up the difference in their minimum dignity floor? That one's really not a tax question, you might be thinking. But then it goes into another pot, Chris, that does have to do with taxes. Don't you need to include a forecast of income tax expenses in your minimum dignity floor? Or do you consider income to be net of income taxes when you calculate the level of secure income you will need to cover any shortfall? You probably covered this in the shows in the past, and I just missed it. He is right. We did cover this in the past. Need me to repeat anything on that?
No.
Okay. This one came in from, I don't know where. Guess it doesn't matter. Hi, Jim and Chris. Longtime listener. From Minnesota. He has it right here. I usually look at the bottom of the email. That's where they put their state. So he's from Minnesota. He says, for the minimum dignity floor, there are five elements: food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. But the one I think should also be included is taxes. So he's leading in, is just want us to say we should put taxes in on that. If you don't agree with my suggestion, can you explain why? Okay.
Okay.
This one is from New Jersey. It says, hi, Jim and Chris. I'm writing to hopefully give you another way to explain why you do not include income taxes as... Oh, he's answering the previous question. I'm writing to hopefully give you another way to explain why you do not include income taxes as a minimum dignity floor expense. Please just say that we need enough after-tax secure income to cover your minimum dignity floor. You are making that point without saying it clearly. Minimum dignity floor expenses do not include income taxes, but we need to determine our income tax expense based on the source of our secure income. I know that's your point, but I think folks would understand better if you emphasized more the need to just compare secure income on after-tax basis to a minimum dignity floor. Mm-hmm. Nothing more needs to be said. So that was his point.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of answered the previous question. Okay, and the last one we got in, we got this one in last week, and it's from California. Hi, Jim and Chris, and wonderful backup team. I appreciate your podcast and the invaluable education I have received from you over the past couple of years. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your wonderful advice and explanations. Why, you're welcome, you're welcome, you're welcome. I have been following the most recent show on minimum dignity floor and do not understand where federal and state income taxes come into play. My husband and I pay taxes for our Social Security and for our pension. Since this is considered our secure income, shouldn't the taxes we pay out of this income be part of our minimum dignity floor? Thank you in advance for addressing this question.
Okay.
Any you need me to repeat? Do you want me to run these across the
no.
hall to give you?
No, I think, and the reason why I was able to take notes so efficiently on this, and I didn't even use a full sheet of paper as you went through that, is that there are questions that come up regularly on this, and also, and actually questions we asked ourselves internally as we were kind of working through how we're going to deal with this. These are all things that came up before we even released this as an idea to the public. I think there, although one was a recommendation about how we approach this, and I'll touch on that one. That was question or email number four, as from New Jersey, that came through here. But these are questions that are, I want to give kudos to our listeners, because they are the questions that we thought needed to be addressed as we built this whole process and the way we approach these things. As well. So they're picking up on exactly what should be considered as part of this topic of taxes. So I guess you can probably take a break for a minute, because it is going to take me a bit, I think, to walk through how we approach this and how to
all right.
deal with this and
I'll
to address all
car.
Five of these. So
I'll
you
go
can,
wash the car.
Anyway, I'll although I might abruptly just stop and say, Jim, what do you think?
True. All right. So I won't leave. Go ahead. You can go. I told everyone he's going to answer this question, folks. So plus, you know how he gets. So
yeah, exactly. Well, you gave me a lot to cover.
I did
here,
five
so,
questions.
Yeah.
Go for it.
So the first thing I'd like for people to just come from the right perspective or the frame of mind when considering this. Keep in mind always that in devising protection for these expenses, and our protection being the proposal to use secure income as the coverage for these minimum dignity floor expenses, we are imagining a world where all of your other assets are gone. We want to create a foundation or floor below which you cannot fall, even if you had no assets. and therefore you need enough income to come in and cover the food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, because you have no other resource to come in. And if you were in that situation, there may very well be some tax burden, but there may not be any tax burden. And you might think, well, how is that possible? Well, if your main source of income or your only source of income at that time is Social Security rules on taxation are such that many people that only have Social Security income pay zero income tax, even if they're in a state with income tax. Or if maybe your secure income sources are some little bit of Social Security and then an annuity, an income annuity that was in a Roth account. All that income is tax-free, and if the Social Security is small enough, it would also be received tax-free or with minimal, very minimal tax burden on it. So you might have a case, and quite a few people actually, where they'd have no tax burden on that, but other people might. And there was the mention of the person from California, the last one, where they said they had Social Security and pensions, and they paid income tax on just that income. Well, that's saying that they're between their pension, which is considered ordinary income, and their Social Security, which has some beneficial treatment from tax for tax purposes. But the combination was big enough where they actually had a tax obligation, income tax obligation, just on that income. So even if they had no other assets, and I'm not saying this person is in that circumstance, hopefully they're not, but even if they were, they'd still have to pay those taxes in order to qualify or to cover their minimum dignity floor expenses for life. So there's variations in what's going on here. So I just wanted to, I guess, set the stage for envisioning a time where all your resources to cover these expenses just exist as secure income itself. That's going to help you understand a little bit how we attack this and why we think the way we do. Before I dig any deeper into the income tax side, though, I do want to mention, like Jim, because Jim really brought it up. It wasn't one of the questioners, but he pointed out that there's lots of other taxes, property taxes, sales taxes on all the stuff that you buy, excise taxes, taxes on the, you know, gasoline, etc. Those other taxes that aren't income-driven taxes are covered through the expense estimates that we use for your food and your utilities, your transportation, gasoline. We don't ask you for the net cost, net of tax. We want the whole ball of wax. What do you pay at the grocery store, even when you pay sales tax on that? What do you pay for property taxes as part of your housing expense? So those taxes, they are absolutely a form of a tax, are handled in the cash flows themselves, the actual expenses. So we can kind of do away with that part pretty easily and just focus on the income tax side of it. So a lot of people believe, since we don't name them, food, utilities, transportation, housing, healthcare, and go on to say income tax, that we're ignoring it. We aren't. But as the person from New Jersey pointed out in their recommendation about how we talk about this, we address it on the income side of it. Because like I mentioned a moment ago, if the income comes in from a source that has no taxes, we don't have to worry about income taxes. That was my example for the person had Roth annuity income versus taxable, etc. If they have a lot of taxable income, say pensions is their main source, and they don't get any kind of beneficial treatment, then they're going to have taxes owed on that secure income. That must be considered. So the person from New Jersey who prompted or proposed that we always talk about it as after-tax secure income, I'm almost convinced that that solves this problem of confusion as we talk through this. It comes close. I would still worry that people are thinking that they have to factor in the taxes on the assets above and beyond the income. Most people look at their whole situation and they don't mentally compartmentalize and say, well, let's imagine for a second we have no IRA, no 401k, and let's ignore all the taxes that we're going to have to worry about as we take money out of there. That's not really how they think. They're always worried, and especially if you listen to this podcast, at this point you'd be aware of RMDs and the fact that that's all going to come out as income and be subjected to income taxes at that time at the federal and state level if you live in a state that has an income tax. They don't think of them any differently, and we really need, that's why I started this whole thing with, imagine not having any of those. That's what sets the minimum level of secure income that you need. Those other income taxes on the RMDs, for instance, are going to be covered not with secure income unless you want them to be. When, remember, what we're doing is we're just getting a guiding figure, a planning figure for how much you need to have in the secure income itself as a minimum to protect that minimum dignity floor itself. If you have more than that, it's not horrific. It's not anything wrong with it. So you might actually be able to, in certain circumstances, cover some of those taxes with secure income. But we're not going to pitch that to you as needed. That could be a choice that you've got. So the people that pointed out a number of them, what about those taxes on the RMDs that I'm taking out, etc.? Well, as Jim alluded to, as he was kind of doing the setup, if you have those RMDs, which generate income taxes, then you must have the asset still. You must have the IRA or 401k so that any taxes owed there can be satisfied by the account itself. They don't have to rely solely upon the secure income. And if those assets went away so they weren't available to pay the tax, they wouldn't be generating the tax in the first place. So they kind of are, we're all about making these matches. We're trying to match your minimum dignity floor to your secure income. And here's an income tax we're matching to what generates the income tax, the account behind it. If the account goes away because you spent it all or it drops or whatever happens to it, give it away, etc., you won't have the tax anymore. But if you have it, it generates the tax, you can pay the taxes from that. So that's why we look at income taxes not as just one big thing, but what's the source? What's generating the income tax? And if it's being generated by the act of covering your minimum dignity floor via our method of using secure income, then absolutely those income taxes need to be factored in. And you can do it like the New Jersey person talked about with considering the income as an after-tax value and is there enough after-tax. I don't think I'm going to, I'll probably say that more because I think it's a good idea generally moving forward, but I don't think I'm going to be able to avoid having to point out we don't mean after all taxes. We just mean after the taxes associated with the secure income itself if you had no other assets. And that's still kind of a long, you know, title to put on it, if you will. So are we ignoring taxes? Absolutely not. Do we want to include it as a sixth category? It just doesn't work quite right that way because it's dependent upon the income. It's not dependent on your lifestyle. It's not like food, utilities, transportation, and housing, and healthcare like everyone has. Not everyone will have that sixth category, and it's not even generated by you being a living, breathing human being that needs these things satisfied for the rest of your life. Taxes are generated by the source of the income. So I think it is more appropriate for us to factor it in on that side. So I'm fully in alignment with the New Jersey person on thinking about it that way. Just how do we apply it and describe it to people takes a little bit of nuance. So I think that touched on everything other than, I want to go back to the very first question just for a moment, because they threw in a little twist. They talked first about, what about those pesky taxes on the RMDs? And I think we handled that by talking about how those, the RMDs themselves, if they're generating taxes you have to cover, well, you've got the asset that creates the RMD to pay the tax. You know, problem, quote, solved, essentially. Not that you don't want to analyze it. That's a tax analysis, but we're not talking about that today. The second part, though, they said, well, if you don't factor it in and cover those taxes on those RMDs, which might be funding things like your fund budget, right? How do taxes affect your fund number? Well, they do. They absolutely do. So I'm going to take a little segue. We didn't do this show about the fund number specifically, but ultimately, that's why we identify the minimum dignity floor and then get it covered or protected for life, because our goal is to get you to talk about the more exciting things in retirement, the fun stuff. which we say could be funded by your fund number, which is the purely discretionary pool of funds that you have left over after you've protected the minimum dignity floor, any type of guaranteed inheritance, aging and long-term care concerns, extra buffers or reserves for protection. Then you're left with this pool of fund money, which is a topic for another series of shows, but I wanted to address it because they brought it up, because I'm sure somebody picked up on it and is thinking about it too. It absolutely does, but it's not across the board standardized. It depends on where that pool of money that's left over, purely discretionary, sits. If it's sitting in a pool that has little or no income tax implications, then there isn't much of a tax adjustment. But if all that pool is sitting in a 401k or IRA, then it's 100% taxable, and you have to look at your fund number, the gross number, and say, well, gee, there's going to be a big tax burden as I take that money out, especially if I take it out quickly in the early years of retirement. So I really, that doesn't represent my spending on fun, but it represents the distributions I can make on fun. And we need to make some adjustment when we come up with our bucket list as we're sitting across the kitchen table, which is where I usually imagine people out there having conversations with their spouse to decide what they're going to go do during the early years of retirement that we call the go-go period. So it does absolutely affect the fund number, but there's not just a thing. It's not like I can tell you, well, once we get to your fund number, adjust it by 20% because there's going to be some taxes. I might tell you, you don't have to adjust it at all. You've maybe been a very aggressive in contributing to and converting to Roths, and maybe most of your money or all of it is in Roth. I can say, well, this fund number here has very little tax implications. Go for it. You can set up your budget based on this number here without further adjustments. Other people, the opposite end of that spectrum, it's all taxable. So beware, this number here does not represent your spending potential. You're going to have to adjust a bit for taxes in that. And we can look at, ultimately, there's not a simple answer to that. We have to look at how quickly you plan to pull it out of there to spend it. And that will help us anticipate how burdensome those income taxes will be. If it's a big pool of money in your fund number, it could be quite burdensome in taxes if you're taking out vast amounts to satisfy your bucket list in the early years. If you're making $300,000 a year distributions from your 401k, no, not many people do that. This is for exaggerated effect. But doing that, you can imagine there'd be lots of taxes on that. If you're pulling it out reasonably and taking out $50,000 a year to satisfy your fund, then there's not going to be nearly as egregious tax adjustments that need to be made to arrive at your after-tax fund number. So I wanted to touch on that. Since they brought it up, it absolutely does affect the spendable portion of your fund numbers, the way I would describe it. There may be taxes. There may be significant taxes. There may not be any. Probably somewhere in the middle, but that any money you send as taxes is obviously not available for you to spend on yourselves for fun. So I wanted to touch on that too. So I think that, if you're still with me,
I'm here. I'm here. I did not go to my car.
I think I touched on, and I mean, these had a lot of similarities, so I didn't have to tackle them all independently, but I think I addressed what was brought up here. What do you think?
I think you covered it. I would expect, because so many of our listeners are what I now affectionately call VGs, Vanguard engineers. They like to get deep into the weeds. It doesn't surprise me we get these questions on taxes, and everybody needs to look at them. And we're not certainly downplaying the importance of taxes. I just like people to understand, Chris and I like to do taxes the way we do, because we don't believe in annuitizing taxes as part of the minimum dignity floor, especially taxes owed on withdrawals from assets. It makes no sense to annuitize those. If you have the money to withdraw, you will have the money to pay the taxes. And even though we talk a lot about income annuities, and we believe in them as a supplement to pension and Social Security, we much favor Social Security first, pension second, annuities third, we don't want people to put more in an annuity than they need to. And if you're a long-time listener, not even a long-time, just an occasional listener to the podcast, you'll be able to figure that out with our encouragement of people to wait before buying an income annuity. Don't buy them early. You may determine you need X amount of dollars in the future because there's going to be a shortage. Wait to the future to buy the income annuity. It carries over to taxes as well. There's no need to cover taxes that are going on expenses that are going to be covered with withdrawals from savings. If you have the savings, you have the money to pay the taxes. It doesn't mean we don't include the taxes. As that other listener pointed out, Chris, we look at after-tax dollars. But even that is hard to project. I wish Bob was on this podcast. He'd be able to, Bob being the CPA folks, Bob would be able to add a lot more clarity to how much people's income varies, how much their tax burden varies in any given year, and how almost impossible it is to accurately every single year project what taxes would be. So you think projecting your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses is difficult. Try projecting taxes, which is open to the whims of politicians that seem to change it every other month with this is an exemption, that's an exemption, here's a new tax, there's an old tax gone away. It can get difficult. So it's not that we don't cover taxes. We definitely do. We definitely believe in addressing them. We probably just don't do it in as clear a manner as food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare.
Well, it's so nuanced between different circumstances. There's not really nuance to food. The only nuance is how much do you spend on there, period. I mean, it's really what kind of food do you like to eat? Where do you shop? Here it is. You spend $800 a month. You spend $1,000 a month. You spend $1,200 a month, whatever the number is. There's really no nuance to that. There's a lot of nuance to the income tax story. So it has to kind of be looked at subjectively and critically and decide how does this all factor in and what taxes, if any, income taxes specifically, if any, do we want to build into the secure income portion as far as covering some portion of taxes. And for some people, it's a very minimal issue. And other people, it's pretty substantial, mostly those with substantial taxable secure income, aka pensions. So it varies a lot from person to person and is a lot more specific than the other five categories. Those are all actually pretty straightforward once you get them nailed down.
Okay. Well, we have a bunch of other questions. That's why we're going to keep doing this. I'm trying to mix it up a little here, folks. Hopefully, these tax questions made sense. Minimum dignity floor represents, as I've said time and time again, 60-70% of how you're going to fund your retirement. These are big categories. Food is the smallest. Healthcare is the largest. Sometimes housing, which is just under healthcare in any given year, might be greater than healthcare. But they're listed from smallest to largest. They are very important expenses. I like this next question because there's no set answer to it. But he brings up what I feel is a very important concept of retirement planning. Not only as it relates to the minimum dignity floor, but relates to your retirement as a whole. So he reads, "Hi, Jim and Chris. Just finished listening to your Minimum Dignity Floor podcast. As a career accountant that compared actual results to budgets and forecasts, I'm assuming that every so often a plan must be revisited. Mm-hmm. My question is, how accurate are you in your forecasts? I agree with Jim that retirement planning is not the spreadsheet, but the continuous monitoring. Although I do a pretty detailed expense budget and compare actual results every month," that's a VG right there, every month, "what I've learned is that things always change, but overall my household is fairly consistent and good at sticking with the budget." Mm-hmm. "I've also learned that sometimes too much detail," he gets this from Chris, or Chris got this from him. What I'm about to read to you, folks.
Probably music to my ears.
It's music. Chris It took him a while to get me. I was a VG, people, and probably to an extent far more than what anyone on this podcast thinks. And I would sometimes tell Chris and Justin, the original junior years ago, I want to be able to analyze this. I want to be able to analyze that. I want to be able to take this and look at that. And Chris would begrudgingly at times do it, but also not hesitate to point out to me, this is going to add maybe 20% more time, 8% more cost, and maybe get us 0.5% more accurate. It took me a while, did it not, Chris, to finally understand what you were saying?
Yeah, it took a while.
Because, folks, he writes this, I have also learned that sometimes too much detail doesn't add a ton of value. Mm-hmm. How critical is it that you get to the level of detail that you do in your planning? Just curious, as others may be thinking the same thing. I think what he's asking, Chris, we do go to a level of detail probably far greater than many listeners. Not all, because we have some Vanguard engineer type people here for sure. We go to great lengths. I'm telling you now, we go to, I don't want to say less of a great length than we did 10 years ago, but Chris has really simplified it, but has not reduced the accuracy of the plan. I was much more anal when, oh God, do you remember the printed budgeting guide? Mm-hmm. And having people literally tell us, how often are you going to replace the tires on your car? Do you ride the brakes or not? We're going to be replacing the brakes more. Are you buying an extended warranty or not? If so, mm-hmm. what type? Oh my Lord, that's just transportation. How deep I used mm-hmm. to get.
How thick is the bacon?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Chris got me to see the trees because of the forest with the trees, right? Mm-hmm. You, no, the tree. You got me to see the tree, not the forest. That, hey, you don't have to get that deep. So why don't you address that to this listener and all? Do they have to get as anal as some of these VGs are going to get with their Excel spreadsheets? And the reason I'm honing in on transportation, you simplified life for our clients when you got rid of probably 28 pages on transportation mm-hmm. expenses and replaced them with the simplicity of AAA. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, so let's talk about how he started his email about accuracy. With respect to the minimum dignity floor, the good news is, we know how your minimum dignity floor behaves for the most part. Why? Because guess what? You've been practicing now for 45 years eating food. And you know what kind of food you eat. And with a little introspection, you can, if you, even if you're not a budgeter and keeping track of it, with paying attention for a little while, you can figure out what you usually spend on food at the grocery store. Some people already track it when they come to us. Other people need to kind of watch it for a while and determine it. But there isn't a variable like, gee, I wonder what kind of food they're going to eat and how much they're going to consume, etc. You've been practicing, and the assumption is you're going to continue eating kind of like you did before retirement. You're not going to change that behavior significantly. Utilities, you know what you've been paying. You've been practicing living with utilities for a very long time, and you've now established what kind of house you like to live in and the area that you like to be in, which are the driving factors for utilities. And so you share with us, this is what I've been paying on utilities for the past X number of years. And that's reasonable to assume that's going to continue into the future, unless you're having us model a geographic change or a complete change of household. And then we do have to go down the road of, well, how do you think that's going to change your water bill, your electric bill, your this, that, and the other thing? But if you're not planning to do that, it becomes fairly straightforward and quite reliable in our opinion. So I'm not going to go through every category. The people might be saying like healthcare is unique, but the good news is when you reach 65, things become quite clear because Everyone pays the same Medicare premiums. It's not variable, like all the variability that you face with medical expenses before age 65. There's some small variations, but we assume to be conservative that you're going to have a full suite of Medicare coverage, et cetera. So we make a few assumptions in our projections. Usually, whenever we're making a general assumption, we're going to err on the conservative side. So therefore, for expenses, that would mean, you know, what is the little more expensive option for people? And then if their reality is a little less expensive, that's just a bonus. So with minimum dignity floor, there's fewer variables than you might imagine. And so I think the projection of the minimum dignity floor, the anecdotal feedback that we've gotten for people that we've done plans for over time is that their minimum dignity floor does track about the way we expected, although we look at it kind of average. What is an average year? In reality, if you're going to track it real carefully, you're going to notice month-to-month variations and even year-to-year variations, because certain things in the minimum dignity floor are sporadic, like repairs to your house or washer and dryer purchases, etc. But the feedback I've gotten, and as we've done updated plans for people, I don't have them coming back and saying, oh, we were way off on this part of the minimum dignity floor. We spend way more than that or way less than that. We make tweaks to it, and that's it. So following up updates, that's why we do the updates, is make sure that we're not drifting away from what we expected and something surprising hasn't arisen. So that's on the accuracy part. As far as how detailed do you really need to get? Well, you need to get as detailed as it takes to get reasonable projections, but no more detailed than that. And Jim historically had fallen down the detailed rabbit hole where we kept coming up with new things to consider and worry about, and, oh, what about this? And, gee, if we're going to factor that. And he brought up automobile warranties. We know some people are fans of those. Other people aren't. Well, we would actually adjust the cost estimates for the vehicle by adding the extra cost to the warranty, but reduce some of the maintenance costs that we would normally project. We got to that level before I could convince him to step back from that madness, in my personal opinion, because first of all, those are such unpredictable things that we just need a reasonable estimate for what you're going to spend on these things. And the most important factors that we determined needed to be considered for cost of a car, for instance, because that's basic transportation for most people, happened to be the same variables that AAA, which I would probably call out as an expert in what it costs to own and operate a car, that they've been eating, breathing, and living that for how many decades now, and they have millions of members that they gather information from. Well, the two factors that are important are what type of vehicle do you drive and how much do you drive it. That's really it. Those two are the key driving factors, and personal behavior beyond that will have a marginal effect on those costs, but really, those two big ones, if you can nail those down, you're going to have a pretty good estimate. And so we use that, and I've mentioned this before, but I'll repeat it here since Jim brought it up. We use how much you typically drive. Some people live in an area they drive a lot. Out west here, we tend to drive a lot. Everywhere you go is a distance, if you will, and there's really no public transportation. And what kind of car do you like to drive as part of your standard of living? And we then match those two pieces of data to the fixed and variable costs that AAA provides as a huge publicly available database of information about different types of cars, mid-size SUV, small-size SUV, hybrid car, heavy-duty truck. You know, there's all these different categories that they have data of what it really costs in the fixed category and the variable being those costs driven by how much you drive the car, the mileage per year. And we use that, and it makes it easy for us to gather the information, and we are using the reliability of the comprehensive nature of the cost estimates that AAA provides, because when you dig into their data, they are considering every piece: oil changes, changing brakes, replacing the car itself, gasoline, windshield wipers, insurance, all that stuff they've got thrown in there. And we now don't have to ask people to give us that 23 pages of gee, do you buy an extended warranty? And how often do you trade in your car? And all that. I mean, it was just on and on and on about it because we were trying to be as accurate as possible. But when we realized that a lot of people don't even think of all the things related to driving a car, and AAA doesn't forget anything because this is what they do, and we feel that we actually get better estimates using that more, I would even call it somewhat generic information from AAA rather than asking you specifically about your circumstances.
And if I could, to carry on with this, and again, I'm a recovering VG. I'm a recovering alcoholic, I guess. Because I did and always had gone to that depth. And I thought you had to. And as I did this more and more and more planning, being quote-unquote this, and started seeing the results of the analysis, a few things started dawning on me. What we were calling the retirement plan wasn't even close to being the retirement plan. What everybody here probably listening thinks is the retirement plan is nothing more than the data gathering and projection phase of retirement planning. The plan, as I've been trying to get people to understand, the actual plan is the ongoing monitoring, maintenance, upkeep of the interaction of your whole distribution phase. How does your health care, meaning Medicare and things like that, how does that interact with your estate plan, which interacts with your tax plan, which interacts, of course, with your minimum dignity floor, your fund number, your secure income? And it started to dawn on me, Chris, I was constantly striving to get the bullseye. I thought that was the most important. To have an analogy, and this may resonate maybe with 8% of our listeners because that's the amount of the population that hunts. When I'm targeting in, before I became a cop, I was a competitive pistol shooter. I was never that good, but I really enjoyed it. And I was just in awe of some of the people and what they could do on a competitive shooting course. And I would try, and I would try my hardest, and it was always about getting close to the bullseye and fast. Now, the fast analogy doesn't tie in here. We don't rush through these plans. But the bullseye analogy does. In competitive shooting, it's all about getting on the bullseye. In hunting, it's getting on the pie plate. A pie plate, the standard pie plate is about, is it 7 or 9 inches? God, it's been so long since I forgot. I believe it's 9 inches. Mm-hmm.
Right in there, yeah.
And that's about, if you're going to harvest your elk, I generally wait for the broadside, and I try to get it into the heart area, sometimes the lung area. It's about a 9-inch, quote-unquote, kill zone, if you will, and I hate to use that verbiage, but that's what it's called. I just have to get on that. I don't need to get in the exact center, anywhere on that pie plate. I know that elk will be successfully harvested. Even if I miss the pie plate a little, as long as I don't miss by a foot, everything is going to be fine. And when I sight in my rifle every hunting season, honestly, Chris, here's how I do it, folks. I'll go out at 100 yards and then 200 yards. I sight in at 200 yards, and I have an adjustable turret on my scope, and then I can base it on the distance of the animal from me, and I have the ballistics of my rounds set so I know where on my scope to turn. Hunters will understand what I'm talking about. But when I'm sighting it in, I put the pie plate there, and in the center of the pie plate, I put a 1-inch bright orange dot. That's where I'm aiming for, but I don't care if I hit that 1-inch dot or if I hit the corner of the pie plate. I really don't. Now, the perfectionist, Jim, he wants to get as close to that orange dot as possible. Hunting, Jim, he just wants on the pie plate. And I can drop and harvest my animal if I'm on the pie plate. That's retirement planning when it comes to the minimum dignity floor expenses. You don't have to nail it. You got to be on that pie plate. There is room to vary. There's variance built into this. You don't have to be exact. And it eventually dawned on me the futility of trying to predict what the cell phone bill of a retiree at age 79 is going to be when they're 65 today. I don't even know if there'll be a cell phone at 79 if you're 65 today. Seriously, I don't know what the future's going to bring. And 20 years ago, there probably wasn't many people with a cell phone bill. It changes. You have to evaluate your plans all the time. When I used to do what Chris does, I would generally begin my presentations. So you do-it-yourselfers keep telling yourselves this. Every time you sit down at your Excel spreadsheet that as an engineer type you feel has to be on that little one-inch orange dot and not anywhere on the pie plate, I'm telling you, it just has to be on the pie plate. And as a hunter, it can be off an inch or two from that pie plate. You may have to track that elk for 30, 40, 50 feet or yards, but it's still going to go down. If you get on that pie plate, though, you're probably going to drop that elk where it stands. But what I want you to take from this little pie plate analogy or tirade, when it comes to retirement planning, you're looking at the trends. I would begin every presentation with something similar to this. Let's say Chris was my client, him and his wife, Melissa. I would say, Chris, Melissa, everything I'm about to review with you is wrong. And it's wrong because I cannot tell you what is going to be happening to you in 15 years, let alone 5 years, or even 5 days from now. But what I can do, and what we did do for you, is analyze everything we know today as being true because you shared with us the data. We projected it going forward as reasonably as we could, and we're looking at the trends. I don't need to precisely predict or project, not predict, the cost, excuse me, the cost of your cell phone bill in 15 years, but I have to be able to project the trajectory of that bill. It's the projections I'm looking at. Taxes are going up, inflation is going up, expenses are going up, asset values are most likely dropping or maintaining, secure income is probably staying level because it doesn't have a COLA adjustment, Social Security, though, may be going up by CPI projections. These are very broad categories or analysis, if you will. They don't have to be exact, but we would look at the trend line. And it made sense, Chris, because we visualize all this for our clients. We used to look at numbers. Remember this, Chris? We would look at numbers, spreadsheets or PDFs of spreadsheets, numbers. And I got so fed up with it. I hired, he used to be a planner, to take all of these numbers and put it in an Excel spreadsheet. What was his name? Gabe, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Gabe?
Gabe.
Mm-hmm. He was wicked good and probably still is with Excel. But he was a former CFP who knew what we were talking about, what we were trying to do. And I told him, Gabe, I'm just interested in the trends. I'm no longer interested in the accuracy of that cell phone bill 15 years from now. But I'm interested in the trends of all of these variables, whether it be Social Security, cost of living, minimum dignity floor expenses, secure income, fund numbers, all of these different numbers, which were the result of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different calculations. I just want to look at the trends and visualize the trends. He wrote spreadsheets for us to be able to do that with line graphs and bar graphs. And then we turn that into the actual presentation to people, because if there's anything I can't stand, the regurgitated generic outputs that most professional financial planning software programs do, and you end up getting 60, 70, 80 PDF pages of gobbledygook that you're not even going to pay attention to. We threw all that away, and we replaced it with a few Excel spreadsheets that we show people on different tabs, visualizing all that data. And here's what's key. When we visualized all the data, not only in minimum dignity floor, but in other things, but we're concentrating on minimum dignity floor today. When we started projecting minimum dignity floor as individual bar graphs, the first thing Chris and I, and at the time it was just Chris, myself, and then Chris, myself, and Justin, we could instantly, Chris, tell if there was an error in any of our data entry. Remember that? Because as soon as we see the, we know after years of doing this, what we felt a what a minimum dignity floor series of bar graphs should look like. Mm-hmm. And if there was, if it should be going from the lower left to the upper right, we also knew the speed at which it should go up. And if we saw it going up at a quicker speed, or more importantly, divots, unexplained drops or unexplained increases, that told us what, Chris?
We had some anomaly in there. Could have been an error. Could be some unique thing that was included that the clients actually threw in there. Could be justified. But it was amazing how, after seeing all those trends, that your eye is so good at picking up anomalies or differences from normal. And so, you know, people that see them that we present them to only see kind of one of them. But we've seen, at this point, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, and it's pretty easy to pick up on issues.
We can instantly tell. If you are just staring at row after row, cell after cell, column after column of numbers, you're not going to see it. It's going to be, what's the saying? Is it you can't see the forest for the trees, or the trees for the forest?
The forest for the trees.
You can't see the forest for the trees. So if you are just staring at numbers, you can't see the forest for the trees. Is that the right saying in this case? Mm-hmm. Okay. Because there's just so much. The key isn't the accuracy of your cell phone bill 15 years from now when you're 78. The key is the trend of that cell phone bill. Be on the pie plate. Don't concentrate on that orange dot. You don't, surprisingly, have to be accurate on all of these items. Now, you can't, again, in my analogy, you can't be too far off that pie plate, folks. You can't. If you're a hunter, you might have a little bit of a tolerance to be an inch or two off of that 9-inch pie plate at 200 yards or 300 yards or 400 yards, depending on where you're harvesting your elk. You can't be that far off that pie plate, though. But if you're on that pie plate, the end result is the same. You're going to be having elk breakfast sausage in a week or two when it comes back from the butcher. Same thing as you project your minimum dignity floor. Don't fixate and get over analytical on every little expense. Be on the pie plate. Visualize it. Turn it into bar graphs. I find bar graphs better than line graphs. It's just, I think, a personal preference. You'll eventually be able to see anomalies. You'll see drops. Why is this dropping? We get this all the time. We always plan as a team here at our firm. And when Chris gets the data from Junior Junior and pulls it up, we can right away. No, okay, everything looks fine. Or, hey, what's going on? Why is it dropping there? What's happening here? And then we'll back in and try to find out what the anomaly is. Some of it is easily explainable. Some of it is programming errors on our behalf. And it's a wonderful way to find it. But we don't sit with Chris, who presents to us on Tuesdays on these, and I don't say to him anymore, Are they buying an extended warranty, Chris, on every new car purchase? And did you find out, is it the 3-year, 5-year, or 7-year extended warranty? He'd kill me if I said that again. He literally would. He'd come into my office and wring my neck. It doesn't matter. He got on that pie plate with the way we do it. So as you people are doing this, you're going to spend, but I'm trying to get you guys to understand, and I apologize for going on and on here. I'll wrap up. But stop being anal on all the different elements of the minimum dignity floor. Simplify it. Don't stop monitoring it. That's the plan. It's going to change every year. Don't worry about it. Change with it. Don't worry about projecting the correct inflationary rate. We still are projecting the historical long. You haven't raised it from 3 yet, have you? The historical long-term rate, even though it's been 8 for the past 12 months?
No, the long-term, we're talking 20, 30 years, right. So a little 2-year anomaly isn't.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's not to say Chris won't change this in 3, 4, mm-hmm. 5 years. If this turns out to be a little bit more long-lasting and pulls the long-term rate up, but we're not sweating over it. We get clients who ask us about this a lot, and we'll tell them. Next year, when we update your data numbers, because that's all the initial Excel spreadsheet that you have, Navi output is what we use. It's just data projections. How you interpret that data, that's the plan. Now, that might be where our knowledge and understanding can outweigh your ability to program Excel. We have the experience, the knowledge, the understanding with Bob's tax knowledge, Chris's retirement knowledge and Social Security knowledge, my IRA and distribution knowledge. We all have those specialties. We may be able to interpret the data better than you, but you should be able to project the data probably as accurately as Navi does. Maybe not so much on the tax side, but on the minimum dignity floor side, that's fairly straightforward. But updating that data set and then seeing how that impacts your estate, your health insurance, which is Medicare, I keep saying that, but Medicare, your estate, IRAs, inheritance, minimum dignity floor, fund number, secure income, your shortages, your minimum dignity floor, delay period shortage and post-delay shortage, your buffer, your reserves, your guaranteed inheritance, your aging plan. All of that is your retirement plan. But it all begins with the data you gathered as you're projecting your minimum dignity floor, your secure income, the shortage, and the reserve to cover it. All right, I went on a little high horse there. I apologize, but I hope people are gaining, because that question was a good question. How accurate do you have to be? You got to be on a 9-inch pie plate at 200 yards, folks. You don't have to be on that 1-inch bright orange dot I put in the center of the pie. I kind of like that analogy. Does mm-hmm. it cover it?
I think the only thing I would add is that let's say you decide, I don't mind aiming for the actual bullseye. I've got the data. Why don't I go ahead and hit the bright orange dot in the middle? That's actually probably not possible. You're overestimating the accuracy of the data. So you are seeking something you really aren't going to achieve, and you can actually get a false sense of precision and accuracy when you're doing forecasts by doing that. So it's almost like it's counterintuitive. So I think you're chasing something that you're not going to catch. And I guess if you have all the time in the world and you have no value to that time, then you can go for it. But I would add that little piece, because if you spend enough time, although I guess in your shooting example that it gets to the point, because there's going to be variables you can't control no matter how much time you spent sighting, adjusting your sight. There's going to be temperature variations and wind and all that other stuff that is reality that you're not going to be able to factor in precisely when you're actually using that thing that you spent all the time sighting it in. So getting as close as you can reasonably, that's going to be good enough for what we're doing here.
Okay. Well, if you want to wrap up, we can. If not, two people want to know your opinion on cuts to Social Security and how it impacts minimum dignity for your minimum dignity for calculations.
That would take more time than we have, since we're already pushing.
Then
past
we'll
the average,
we'll lead so. With those. Okay. So those two people both sent us questions recently on that. Actually, no, one of them is from July of last year, and one of them is from August of this year, just last week. So we'll begin with that. They want to know Chris's opinion on how they should adjust for the pending. They both seem convinced that Social Security is going to be cut, and they want to know how you would handle that.
Good.
From a planning perspective.
Good discussion piece. So,
yeah.
We'll,
so we'll begin there.
Next time. Okay.
Okay.
So does that mean we're destined for a show number five on...
I think we're destined for six, just for any other reason, to put to bed the QLAC show, which apparently for you was worse than, it was like that.
I think I enjoyed The Dentist more.
The Slasher, no, I'm just getting, Psycho. It's like a mixture, the QLAC show for Chris was like a mixture of Psycho and that hockey mask wearing dude, I forget his name, Jason, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Him, and then... I don't know. Let's get some. Oh, the woman. Remember the girl whose head turned around? What was that?
From The Exorcist. Yeah.
So it's like all three of those in one was what the QLAC show was to Chris. I want to put a wooden stake through the heart of the QLAC show for you.
Well, it wasn't the first show or the second.
It was the fifth.
Or the third or the fourth. It's that fifth show that just pushed me over the edge. So anyway.
But we do get questions on minimum dignity floor. And before everybody says, oh, God, another one, it's 60 to 70% of your retirement plan. Or at least your not necessarily the plan. The plan is everything
retirement
else.
Expenses.
The retirement expenses. Yeah. And it all begins with analyzing your expenses and figuring out how you're going to cover them. That's essentially, I don't want to say 90% of retirement planning, but it's about 50% of retirement planning. The other 50% is the interaction of tax planning, conversions, and estate, and monitoring, and all of these things. But this is a big chunk of what you're going to need to do as do-it-yourselfers to begin projecting. And hopefully today, I thought today's show was good because we're trying to drill into you. You just got to be on the pie plate. You don't have to be on the orange dot.
Great.
Now, if you are a hunter and you disagree with me, you're welcome to share. But I tell you, I practice by getting on the pie plate. And ever since I've been doing that, it's much more enjoyable going to the range to sight in, Chris, and cheaper. I don't have to send all these rounds down, and you get out there with your little measure, and you're like, oh, well, I'm 33 centimeters away, or whatever the measurement might come to, so okay, I've got to go two clicks to the right and one click down. It's just, why? Just get on the pie plate. Okay.
Okay. Well, I guess that means people have one more opportunity, at least, but...
Oh, for questions?
For questions, if they sneak them in.
If it's a good question. Well, I'm just saying, we have enough questions as it is.
Okay.
We're not doing more than two
but
more shows
might,
on
someone
this.
Might have something really unique that catches our eye, so don't hesitate. If you think you've got something that we haven't really addressed as part of this conversation on minimum dignity floor expenses and their coverage with secure income, send it our way.
Please, and make sure you put in the subject line like unique or attention or something that your question about MDF is definitely unique and warrants being put on the next two shows. We will not have more than two more shows on MDF.
Yeah.
There's other things that I want to cover. There was a really good article just on Saturday in the Wall Street Journal. I wonder how many listeners picked up on it. I'm not going to say what article it is. We should have if you read Saturday's Wall Street Journal and you're a longtime listener to this show, you picked up an article in there and you're probably saying, when is Jim going to talk about this? Not too far into the future. It was a really good article in the journal this Saturday. I want to opine on that and a few other things. So we're going to get off this MDF horse in the not too distant future.
Perfect. Well, let me tell people where they can send it if they want to send it in. If they want to send an email, go to jim@jimhelps.com. Not go to, send it to jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. And a catchy subject line on the email would be good if you want to capture Jim's attention and maybe get on the next show or two as we close out our discussion on the minimum dignity floor. I just want to thank everybody again for listening and sending in these questions. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.